Well, James Haneker was an American art, book, music and theatre critic around the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century. And he was famous for this saying, "Life is like an onion. You peel off layer after layer only to discover that at the end there is nothing in it. Nothing except tears." I think the woman of Samaria that we meet in John chapter 4 would have agreed with that sentiment. It's not difficult from the little bit we are told about her to imagine the kind of person she was. Like most of us, she was looking for happiness, but unfortunately, happiness kept eluding her grasp. The current man in her life, we're told, was number 6. Now, some advocates of the permissive society would no doubt hail this as a testimony to the unfettered joy of sexual liberation. But I'm pretty sure she didn't see it that way. She had hoped, like many, that love and marriage would make her life worthwhile and give it meaning and direction. But somehow, every relationship that she had turned sour. And each time she found a new man in her life and she thought, well, at least this time it could be Mr. Right. She'd hoped that she would not make the same mistake again. And the more emotional tragedy she experienced, the more onion-like her life became. And already the romantic idealism of her youth had hardened into a frustrated cynicism about things. And as for the future, well, that didn't bear thinking about. Age would steal her beauty. Her men friends would no doubt trade her in for a newer, younger model. There would be nothing left for her but the gutter. Perhaps that's where she saw herself now. If truth be known, she was already halfway there. Her self-respect was already in tatters. Why else would she choose to come to this isolated traveller's well at the hottest time of the day, except to avoid the embarrassment of being shunned by all of those respectable neighbours of hers? She would no doubt give anything to relieve the depression and the inner emptiness that haunted her. She felt so insecure, so lonely, but most of all, she felt dissatisfied. Cyril Connolly, an English literary critic and writer, once wrote, "In the small hours when the stench of existence rises like sewer gas from everything created, the emptiness of life seems more terrible than its misery." And yet this woman knows all about those small hours that Connolly speaks about, those sleepless nights born not over the work, but simply through the unrelenting futility of it all. Take that wretched water pot that she carried from the village. There it stood empty again. She'd filled it up yesterday. She'd fill it up again tomorrow. And it's so symbolic of her life. A symbol of a never-ending thirst. She would spend the remainder of her days filling up that pot, and at the end of the day her appetite would still be as insatiable as ever. I don't know whether you've ever had any of those days when you felt so irritated that you just want to pick up a perfectly innocent piece of pottery and just smash it against the wall. But I suspect that this woman sometimes felt a little bit like that with her water pot. Just empty. And as soon as it was filled again, well, it would soon be empty again. That water pot was her. That water pot was her life. And I wonder, is that sometimes how we feel? Kirk Douglas, the Hollywood actor, once likened his life to the script of a B-movie. You know, those going back years when you would have a movie that was played out before the main picture came on. And he said, "My life was so corny. If someone gave me the screenplay to play my life on film, I'd turn it down flat. And there are millions of people with less exciting lives than a Hollywood film star that would no doubt say something pretty similar. They're bored. Bored out of the sheer tedium of existence. They're like a rat trapped in an insoluble maze on that never-ending treadwheel. They're looking for something to shatter the monotony, to fill the vacuum. But the irony is they don't even know what they really want, let alone know where to find it. So they try another job. They try another marriage. They try alcohol. Try drugs. They try the latest fantasy thrill of a picture at the cinema. Or they sit in the evening just transfixed by the TV. They try the lottery, latest holiday brochure. But none of it works. And at best, these things only offer a temporary escape. Because those sleepless small hours always return with the emptiness. Now, we don't really need, do we, the Apostle John to spell out what this woman of Samaria felt about life, do we? She's a woman in whose face we can see the inner anguish of millions of people who daily peel off the layers of their onion-like existence, only to discover that there's nothing there but tears. Now, there might be some parts of John's Gospel as we work through it that are quite hard for us to relate to. But I don't think anyone can say that this woman is not relevant to us in the 21st century. Because you can see 1,000 people just like her within just a square mile of where you live. And that being so, we would do very well to consider her story very carefully. But the account tells us how one day, just out of the blue, quite unexpectedly, this empty woman met someone who, in the space of a single conversation, transformed her emptiness into a sparkling fountain of satisfaction and joy. And John recounts this conversation to us because he's convinced that this someone can do the same for us. John chapter 4. And beginning in verse 4. Now Jesus had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well, and it was about noon, when a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" Now it's interesting, isn't it, that John starts off by saying that Jesus had to go through Samaria. Because the fact is, there was absolutely no necessity for him to go there at all. In fact, pious Jews avoided that particular route like the plague. They preferred to go several miles out of their way rather than risk the social interaction with the despised Samaritans. If Jesus had been in a particular hurry in order to breach his normal practice, well, that might have been understandable, but there's no evidence in the text that his journey was an urgent one. In fact, quite the opposite. In verse 1, now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John. Although in fact, it was not Jesus who baptized, but it was his disciples. So he left Judea and he went back once more to Galilee. So these verses indicate that if it wasn't for some animosity in Jerusalem, then Jesus would have stayed in Judea a little bit longer. So there was nothing pressing for him in Galilee. The only reason then for saying that Jesus had to, that he must go through Samaria, must be because there was this important encounter that was awaiting him en route. In other words, it's John's rather subtle way of telling us that the meeting of this Samaritan woman was not by chance. It took place, as everything took place in Jesus' life, by divine arrangement. This was a divine encounter. There was a must about it. Now, the woman had no idea about it, of course. And nor did Jesus give her any hint of this in his opening remark to her. You know, I can imagine the way some Christians would have treated this encounter. You know, they would have gone straight in, wouldn't they? Straight for the jugular. Are you saved? But Jesus is a model of tact and discretion. He simply asks her, will you give me a drink? He gives no indication that there's any religious element in this conversation at all. And yet the woman's interest is aroused by this remark. In verse 9, the Samaritan woman said to him, you are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? And the reason for her surprise is simple. Jesus was flouting two deeply embedded social conventions of his day. First, he was ignoring the hatred that had kept the Jews and Samaritans in mutually exclusive communities for over 400 years. As John puts it in verse 9, for Jews do not associate with Samaritans. And that was putting it mildly. But second, he was ignoring the rather gentlemanly decorum which forbade a respectable Middle Eastern man from having a private exchange with a woman in public. The rabbis held that it was even improper for a husband to talk with their wife in public. Whatever would they have thought of a man chatting to a woman of such pedigree, of such low moral reputation as this? There can be little wonder then that this woman is taken aback by this strange Jewish man who wanted to engage with her in conversation. And I think there's a moving lesson in that for us. Jesus is not bothered about who we are. He's not bothered about what the world may think about you. He is not hampered in his dealings with us, with people that might have discrimination, whether they be racist, or whether they be sexist, or whether they be any other ist. You see, maybe society has given us a low image. Maybe society has told us that we're not really worth very much because maybe of our ethnic origin, or maybe because we're uneducated, or maybe because we're a woman. But Jesus doesn't think like that. In chapter 3, last week, we saw he was talking to this male Jewish aristocrat, Nicodemus. And now he is talking to a female Samaritan peasant. The social contrast that John is showing us couldn't be more extreme. But Jesus speaks to both of them with equal concern and with equal respect. So whoever you are, you don't need to fear that Jesus is not interested in you. On the contrary, the text is showing us he goes out of his way in order to meet with us. But be warned, once you're in conversation with Jesus, anything could happen. That's how it began for this woman. She was a little intrigued, but it didn't stay like that for long. In verse 10, Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. So the small talk is now quickly dispensed with, and with the skill of a rather master interviewer, Jesus just breaks through the chit chat to challenge the spiritual emptiness that is in this woman's life. And it's hardly surprising that she's not really prepared to be manoeuvred into a religious discussion of that sort quite so easily. So in verse 11, Sir, she says, you have nothing to draw with and this well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and who drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock? Now, commentators differ in how we ought to take that response from her. Some think that she has genuinely misunderstood Jesus. She's taken his words about living water literally and thinks he is offering to tell her about some hidden spring that's nearby. And knowing the place as well as she does, she's understandably sceptical about that. But more likely is that she knew that Jesus was bantering, that he was having some wordplay games with her. You know, this woman had been chatted up by quite enough men in her past to know when they were working some sort of conversational angle. She wasn't a naive person. And so she decided to play along with him. And I suspect that there was probably a mischievous glint in her eye as she responds to Jesus' little jest with her, with some feigned indignation. "Oh, that's big talk, that is, sir. Who do you think you are, then, tormenting a poor working girl like me with offers of running water, when you haven't even got a bucket yourself to lift up from the stagnant pool that you're sitting around? Obviously that water that has been good enough for all of the patriarchs isn't good enough for the likes of you, is it?" But Jesus isn't to be diverted from his purpose so easily. In verse 13 he answers, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water that I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." You know, it's a little bit like if you've been walking through the hillside and you're in the middle of nowhere and, you know, you've taken a water bottle because you know you're going to get thirsty, but it's run out. It's empty. And then suddenly you stumble across one of those little streams, those ice-cold streams that just flow down from the rocks. You're crystal clear, invigorating water, better than anything that you could get out of your local tap. And that's what Jesus is saying he can give to men and women, an inner fountain, a bubbling vitality that satisfies a person's spiritual thirst, not just once, but permanently. And Jesus is saying that he is the answer to the emptiness that gnaws away at our souls, that was gnawing away at this woman's soul. Life with him is no onion. Rather, it's a cascade of fulfillment and joy. And this time, the woman's reply is a little less dismissive. Verse 15. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming back here to draw water." And once again, I expect there's a little bit of playfulness in her words. Again, she's being a little bit sarcastic. She's urging him, never thirsty again, Jesus. I'll have some of that. Give me some of this wonderful water, sir. I can't wait. Carting this pot to and fro every day, it's driving me up the wall. But there is, at the very least, a little wistfulness underlying her words, even if they are a little flippant. For all of her humour, Jesus has struck a very serious chord in her heart. As if she's saying, well, that would be a great trick if you could pull it off. If you could just wave your magic wand and free me of this cycle of drudgery which I'm a victim to. And for Jesus, that's the invitation. Half joking as it may have been, it's enough. And he was conscious of this woman's sense of need. The trouble is, you see, most people aren't willing to make that sort of confession. They insist on pretending, well, look, everything's okay. You ask a person, how are you? How's your week been? Fine. But if the truth were known, most human beings live closer to despair than they will ever admit. And so they just erect all kinds of defense mechanisms against anything that threatens to expose that inner spiritual poverty that they have. And light-hearted self-mockery is one of those defense mechanisms that is most common. And that's really what she was doing here. But deep down inside her, beneath that tongue-in-cheek response, there is a deep spiritual longing in her heart. Now, if we're going to find out what Jesus' answer is to that emptiness inside the human heart, we've got to be willing to confess our need. You know, Jesus put it this way. People that are healthy don't need a doctor. It's only those that are sick. What can the doctor do for a patient who refuses to admit they've got a problem? And of course, the doctor can't do anything. And men are the worst, aren't they? Will they go and see a doctor when they've got something wrong? And of course, if they don't go, if they don't admit that they're sick in some way, the doctor can't be of any help at all. What Jesus is saying here. So don't come to Dr. Jesus and say, "It's all right." If you do that, there's not really much he can do, is there? You must be willing to admit that my life is empty. That I'm longing for something. I'm thirsty. And I need something to satisfy that spiritual thirst. See, if you say something like that to him, he's there at your side immediately. But once again, be warned. If you admit a need for Dr. Jesus, then he may prescribe surgery before getting down to giving you the medicine that you need. Verse 16, he told her, "Go and call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. And Jesus said to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man that you are now with is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." Now, Jesus can be a little sarcastic too, huh? Why does he introduce this rather sordid element into the conversation? Surely the woman's love life is her own business. All Jesus is doing by this rather unwelcome intrusion into her private affairs is to risk her storming off in a huff. With all kinds of, "Well, how dare you? I don't have to put up with this. I've just come here to draw water. I don't need to be spoken to like that." See, up until now, Jesus has been the model of discretion. So why does he now display this rather uncharacteristic tactlessness? Well, the answer, of course, is that he has to. And not just in the case with this Samaritan woman, but he has to with all of us. We assume that the root of our emptiness is boredom. My life was just a little bit more interesting, then it would be all right. If I could just find the right job, if I could just find the right marriage partner, then all of my feelings of frustration and dissatisfaction with this life would all disappear, they'd evaporate. And countless thousands of people say that to themselves, but it's not so. Our real problem is not with our job or with our marriage. Our real problem is with ourselves. Our emptiness is at root, not circumstantial in origin, it's moral. And we human beings were made by God with certain behavioural norms in our mind that we've deliberately flouted. We've rebelled against God like disobedient children kicking against their parents' authority. We want to be independent from God, make our own decisions. And as a result, we feel empty inside. We were designed to share the life of God with him. But our foolish insistence on our own way has severed that relationship and has severed the water of life that flows from it. And as a result, it's left us feeling lonely. It's left us feeling insecure. It's left us feeling directionless. And we're at odds with ourselves. We're at odds with one another. And we're at odds with the God who created everything. And what do in response? Well, we spend all of our days trying to plug that gap that God's absence has left. And as often as we try and plug the gap, as this woman did, we find that it never works. For no human relationship, no matter how emotionally intense, can be a substitute for the relationship that we have with God. The relationship that we were made for. Now, you see, before Jesus meets our need, he shows us the diagnosis. And the diagnosis is our moral failure. And it's always a painful experience for that to be exposed. And we saw Jesus talk about that with Nicodemus. People prefer to stay in the darkness because the light exposes. And most of us find guilt something that we'd rather not face up to. Certainly not something that we admire in ourselves. Rather, it makes us feel ashamed and embarrassed. But Jesus insists that it's not enough just to admit that you have a sense of need. You must be able to admit this sense of sin. And no answers can be found until surgery has exposed that moral cancer. You see, we all have skeletons in our cupboard. We all have things in our lives that we can't remember without embarrassment. We all have thoughts lurking in our imaginations that would make us blush if they came out on public view. But such is our pride that most of us engage in a kind of inner psychological conspiracy to conceal that secret shame. And we think we're safe. We think that we can pretend to other people that actually we're not so bad after all. We're quite good people. And we can believe that lie ourselves. But I have to tell you, it's not true. And Jesus sees through that sort of camouflage that we present. You see, our lives are transparent to his gaze. He sees the deeds and the thoughts as clearly as he saw this woman's 6 love affairs. And he insists that we see them too. That we build the new kind of life that he wants to give us on this rather humiliating self-knowledge that we are moral failures, that we are spiritual bankrupts, that we are sinners. You see, he won't let us get away with anything less than that. But the water of life that we are looking for is the gift of God, and God gives it to those who need healing, who need restoration, who need reconciliation. Not those who think they're whole. Not those who think they're all right. Verse 19, "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place that we must worship is in Jerusalem." Now, most commentators looking at that see it as a little bit of a red herring thrown into the conversation by this woman in a desperate attempt to try and change the subject. And I'm sure in measure that was part of what she was doing. Nobody likes to talk about their sin and what's been going on in their life any longer than they have to. Theology is a much less threatening subject and provides all sorts of red herrings for us to divert attention away from our own personal issues. Oh, it's easy to say, well, what about the pagans? What about all of those other religions? What about all of those other Christian denominations? Is it all the same thing, Jesus? Jerusalem or Samaria? And usually it's no more than a smokescreen that people try and throw up to avoid the personal moral challenge that the Bible brings us. Well, you might be criticising me, but what about all of those people over there? What are they doing? But to give the woman her due, in her case it was more than that. Jesus' exposure of her immoral lifestyle had hit home. And she may well have been grateful to get off of the conversation about her husband. But the question that she raises here is more than just some ploy. She'd suddenly realised that this man who she had been speaking to, who she had taken for a rather liberal-minded Jew, was actually a prophet, and a prophet that had supernatural knowledge of her sin. And she knew enough about religion to realise that in such an encounter, meeting a prophet who knew all about her was an indication that she had to get right with God. And so the obvious question for a woman in her position and with her background was, where can I do that? How can I get right with God, and where do I go? Okay, Jesus, you've pointed out my sin. You've told me that my life is wrong. Now, where do I compensate for that? Where do I sacrifice in order to be right with God? At the temple in Jerusalem or the one in Samaria? It might partially have been a red herring, but it's a very valid question. And the multitude of world religions can be a mere diversionary tactic, but it can also be a genuine intellectual problem for people. It does need an answer. And Jesus graciously gives her one. Verse 21, "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshippers must worship in the Spirit and in truth. Now, those words actually speak very important things about the nature of Christianity. Notice first what Jesus does not say. He doesn't say what our tolerant 21st century would want him to say, and that is, well, actually, all religions are the same. All religions are true. The spirit of this age would like him to say, there's no real difference between a Jew and a Samaritan. It's all superficial. It's all historic. We would prefer him to praise the Samaritan religion and urge that Samaritans were already finding their way to God in their own way. But actually, Jesus says nothing of the kind. On the contrary, if you look carefully, you'll see here that Jesus insists that the unique religious privilege of the Jewish people is the historical focus both of divine revelation and divine redemption. They worship on the basis of knowledge. The Samaritans on the basis of ignorance. Now, if that was embarrassing or offensive to this woman, this Samaritan woman's pride, Jesus doesn't spare it. God has chosen to make the Jewish people the vehicle of his plan of salvation. Is it any surprise then they've been persecuted? Is it any surprise then that Satan wants to get rid of them? As a result, nobody is ever going to find spiritual emancipation in this world unless they have dealings with the Jewish culture. For deliverance from sin is something which God has accomplished inescapably in the context of Jewish history. And Jesus insists that's the way it is. And if we're disposed to call it unfair, he might reply that the Jews have paid for that privilege over the centuries with all of the persecution that they've experienced. They've become among the most hated and the most despised and the most persecuted of people. But it's important that we understand this. There's a tendency these days to bathe in nationalistic sentiment. The last night of the Proms, that's a perfect example of the British showing that, isn't it? God who made thee mighty, make thee mightier yet, we sing on that evening. But if you go to Africa or to Asia or to America, you find the same kind of jingoistic pride. President Trump, we will make America great again. Same thing, isn't it? We humans will not accept that we are indebted to any other culture than our own, but it's not true. Each of us, whatever culture we come from, depends on the Jewish people for our knowledge of God. And Jesus is making that abundantly clear here. And we have no choice but to swallow that. But I want you to notice that Jesus actually goes beyond that in his reply to the woman's question. Believe me, he says to her, you stand on the threshold of a new era. A new day is dawning. And yes, it has already come. And one of the characteristics of it is that access to God is no longer tied to any one culture that it was in the past. The historic privileges of the Jews are on the point of becoming obsolete. It will soon be neither a matter of Jerusalem or Samaria. In the new era of the Christian church, it is going to be a matter of the Spirit and truth. Now we need to be very careful in interpreting what Jesus means by those rather enigmatic words, because it's often said that what Jesus is teaching here is that God is non-material, and so therefore he's not localized in any particular place. And so the vital issue here is not where you worship, but how you worship, namely with a sincerity of heart. And you'll hear that explanation many times. And it's true up to a point. The words spirit and truth undoubtedly do emphasize that true worship is not just a matter of mere form. However, if we said no more than that, then we could be excused for thinking that Jesus is just endorsing the sort of liberalism that our 21st century endorses, and that is, it doesn't matter what you believe, so long as you're sincere. It doesn't matter what you believe, as long as your heart is right. To think that would be to misunderstand completely what Jesus is trying to establish here. The fact is, the attitude of our heart in worship has always been important. That is nothing new. God has always despised hypocrisy. He has never been satisfied with mere religious formality. Never. Psalm 51 and verse 17. David says, "My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. You, God, will not despise." See, that was true in the Old Testament. Joel 2 and verse 13 says, "Rend your heart, not your garments." So there's nothing new in those thoughts. And yet Jesus is speaking quite distinctly here about a radical change in the way that men and women relate to God. He's talking about a new time, a new age dawning which has now come. So clearly then, the spirit and truth cannot be mere synonyms for sincerity. There's something more to it than that. And if you study John's Gospel as a whole, you'll discover that spirit and truth are key words that he uses throughout his Gospel. And they're not trite and they're not trivial in their meaning. They're very far reaching and they're very profound. The vital things about these words, when John uses them, is that they are very closely bound up with the person and the ministry of Jesus himself. When John speaks of spirit, he's not merely emphasizing that God is non-material, but he's emphasizing the inner life of God. And he's emphasizing that that inner life of God is available to human beings through Jesus. And when John speaks of truth, he doesn't just mean sincerity of heart. He's talking about the very inner reality of God's being, which has never been fully seen before, but now has become visible to us through Jesus. And when you realize that, it's easy to see that far from endorsing any sort of liberalism in these words, spirit and truth, Jesus is doing, in fact, the very opposite. He tells us here that it's no more a case of everybody worshipping God in his own way in the Christian era than it was before. Yes, the exclusiveness of the Jews has gone, but it's now been replaced by a new exclusivism, and it's the exclusivism of Jesus. True worshippers must worship the Father in the Spirit and truth. And what John means by those words can only relate to who Jesus is and what Jesus has done. We can only worship the Father through Jesus. That's what he's telling us. And Jesus says a little later, John 14 and verse 6, where he says, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." It is then only people who have received the spiritual life and have the spiritual reality of God, which Jesus brings, who are now the true worshippers of God, whom God is looking for in this new era. It's a heart response, all right. But it's not to some vague, generalized idea of God. It's a heart response to Jesus himself. In John 4 and verse 25, the woman said, "Yeah, that's interesting. I know that Messiah is coming. And when he comes, he will explain everything to us." And then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you right now, I am he." And if you're going to get the power of what Jesus is actually saying to her here, you have to realize that that's not exactly the way John wrote it. He didn't actually write I, the one speaking to you, I am he. What he actually wrote was, I who am speaking to you, I am. And to a person like this woman, who would have been familiar with the Old Testament, the person standing in front of her to use that term would have been mind-boggling, even blasphemous. You know, long before Moses had stood at the burning bush and asked God, what is your name? When I speak to the people, who am I going to say has sent me? And God replied, I am that I am. Tell them I am has sent you. That is my name. And so Jesus here is not only claiming to be a prophet, he's not only claiming to be the Messiah, he is actually claiming identity with God. I am is standing before you. The majestic statement that he makes. It means the eternal life that he has been talking about. This water that will satisfy is not just an article that we can add to our list of possessions. Oh no, this water is the divine life of Jesus personified in front of them. And he gives us this water, this life, by giving of himself us. And so the answer to our need is not some new religious technique. It's not even a new religious experience. It is a relationship with the living I am. And it's to such a relationship that Jesus invites this woman at the close of their conversation. And just look at the effect that it had on her. Verse 28. It says, leaving her water jar. You know, John, throughout his gospel, is a master of the apparently incidental detail. The symbol of her emptiness, her water jar, which was empty, that she needed to fill, and it got emptied again. The symbol of her emptiness now lies abandoned there at his feet. She had found the living water. She had found Jesus. Things would never be the same again for her. And so she left the symbol of her emptiness behind. And you know, that can be true for you and me. The steps are exactly the same. Jesus stimulates our curiosity. He reveals a conscious need. He awakens our conscience. He elicits a heart response and brings forth a personal commitment. And perhaps as you read through this passage, you're aware of being somewhere along that chain of conversation with Jesus too. And maybe you and I, as we engage in conversation with Jesus, maybe we have to stop pretending we're fine, that everything's okay. Maybe we have to, you know, own up to the fact that we're empty spiritually. And we have to stop trying to blame others and accept the fact that, yes, I've lived independently of God's will. That I have broken that tie with God. And that there is an emptiness, there's a vacuum in my life. If that's so, let's recommit. Let's commit to Jesus as the only way back into a relationship with the Father. See, Jesus doesn't ask us to abandon our cultural identity. He doesn't give us a long list of rules or rituals to perform. He simply says, come to me. Come to me realizing who I am. And when you come, just ask for the water of life. It's available. Available to us right now. So he says, come. Come and receive it from me. And when you do, then you too can leave your water jar behind.